around supportive housing. We're looking at an inhalation component because we know we do have an overdose prevention site, but it only addresses the needs of injection drug users and not those who inhale their drugs. And about 65 to 70% of people are inhaling their drugs now. So by having an inhalation component, that will bring people who are on a street inside. That also addresses business and resident concerns. So that's why we're trying to look at this. We need to be looking at this holistically, but also looking at the different sectors and how we can work together. We don't want a situation where it's happened in other municipalities where a supportive housing project is put forth and residents and businesses are actively campaigning against it. So we see that this is why we're taking such efforts to involve both businesses and residents, including on working groups.
Yeah, that scenario you laid out where a supportive housing project or another support is voted down by community members does seem to be a recurring story. What would you say to residents who are against this sort of thing or who might think that if you provide these extra resources, you might attract more unhoused people to come take advantage of such resources?
Well, I will say it's interesting. Our unhoused population is not as transient as people think. Every 3 years is a point in time homeless count. And based on that count, the most recent count, which was March 2023, 63% of the individuals had lived in New Westminster for over 1 year and 43% had lived in New Westminster for 6+ years. In a lot of cases, we also have evidence from other municipalities where there are very limited resources like Chilliwack, Abbotsford, Maple Ridge, where they have large homeless encampments. And very few services. And people have both informal and formal support networks, and they're less transient. And I think with regards to businesses, we have to realize if we're bringing people inside, whether that's a 24/7 emergency shelter or that's supportive housing, those individuals are not sheltering in parks and business alcoves and doorways, open burning to keep warm or to cook, discarding belongings. They have access to toilets, which they may not have. So really, in a lot of ways, it's addressing some of the externalities or issues which they're concerned about. And I think we have to change the conversation around that. And part of that is through, that's why RIA is on board with regards to communication. It's trying to work with the community and bring them on side that not doing anything is not an option anymore, that we need to do something and that this will have positive impacts. It may take some time, but it will have positive impacts. And enforcement is also not a solution because it just moves the issue from one area to another. And the courts have stated that people are allowed to shelter overnight in public places. So we do have to look at longer term strategies.
I also wonder if either of you can touch on the importance of using trauma-informed, culturally sensitive principles to navigate these crises and how the group is going about that.
So I did reference the point in time homeless count, and what's interesting about that is based on that count, 3.1% of our population self-identifies Indigenous in New Westminster, but 43% of our unsheltered population self-identifies Indigenous in New Westminster. We also noticed a discrepancy between our unsheltered and our sheltered population, 12% sheltered and self-identifies Indigenous versus 43% unsheltered, which raised questions for us as why where individuals not seeking shelter. And we suspect that those shelters are not culturally appropriate or not meeting their needs. So we really need to rethink with regards to the facilities and services addressing their needs. The other thing we found out in that point in time homeless count that of those who are unhoused and self-identifies Indigenous, 58%, either they or a family member, had experienced residential schools. So there may be a mistrust of government-funded services and institutional-like settings. So sometimes when we think of shelters, sometimes we have rows of beds. And we have to really look at that and also with how we interact with individuals. And I'll turn that over to Brad to get a little bit more around our culturally appropriate response here.
Yeah, so it's both. It's being making sure that you're culturally appropriate for the indigenous, but also making sure that you're trauma-informed in your approach for anybody that's using substance use, whether they're indigenous or not. Both of these populations have had a long history of mistrust in government agencies and maybe haven't necessarily always been treated the best way that they should be or a way that's appropriate for the conditions they're in. And maybe we haven't always been sensitive to what they've experienced, and even healthcare hasn't taken the best approaches. By trying to make sure that our staff and everybody that's engaged in these populations understand the trauma-informed approach and understand culturally appropriateness, we're hoping to build some connections that are meaningful and that can lead to patients opening up, and building a trust in the supports that we're trying to offer them or that we think and that they think are appropriate for them, and collaborate with them to build a patient-centered type approach that is consensual on both sides, where they have the trust in the supports that are being offered, so they will engage the supports in a meaningful way and hopefully end up with a better outcome.
And I just wanted to add there, we have engaged an indigenous-owned and operated planning and facilitation company to inform our staff training around a crisis response team, and also to work with us as we work with the senior levels of government around new facilities, services, and supports to ensure that they're more culturally appropriate and they are meeting those needs. So that is a really important piece of the work. Also, from a staff perspective, learning about the impacts of colonialism in residential schools and ensuring that our staff, when we're having those interactions, are coming at it from a very compassionate point of view and a recognition of the trauma in which Indigenous people have experienced over the years.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the response or feedback has been from the community so far?
We've actually done more than one public engagement session. We've met on several occasions with the Downtown Residents Association, on several occasions with the Downtown Business Improvement Association. We had a joint session with the Downtown Business Improvement Association, the Chamber of Commerce. We've also reached out to faith-based and nonprofits. I will say with residents and businesses, there is kind of a wait and see, wanting to see how the situation will improve, and a lot of questions. But I will say, I think when the information is shared and they get a better understanding of the scope of the pilot and the fact that it's iterative, it is being independently evaluated and it's based on best practices, I think if we can demonstrate that we're not only meeting the needs of the unhoused and those living with mental health and substance use issues, but businesses and residents as to some of the impacts they're experiencing, I think we'll definitely, we'll get more buy-in for the pilot. And as noted, we're hoping that businesses and residents will help us advocate for needed services and supports, including supportive housing and an inhalation component. And part of that is being out in the community, answering questions, being accessible. I don't know, Brad, if you wanted to add anything to that.
Yeah, I mean, we have had several engagement sessions, and obviously this topic can be quite controversial and divisive at times. But what we found is that by taking the time to engage, businesses, the community, and everybody that's involved in a meaningful way, spending your time, making sure that you educate them and remove some of the misconceptions and make sure that they're working from good information, we found that we've had some good success in terms of maybe having a lot of people that maybe initially weren't aligned with what we were trying to do actually joining the project and trying to help us accomplish some common goals. That was part of the reason why we wanted to make sure that we had a communications person as a part of the team to help us get the message out. And we've had some good successes in terms of getting some of that message out to some of the people and building that team that is going to be quite large and collaborative towards working towards that common goal, which will help us with our advocacy that we spoke of earlier.
Are there any challenges that you foresee or roadblocks that you're working on overcoming at this point?
We're not expecting this to be an easy project. these crises, as you've said, are everywhere, and there's a lot of challenges associated with them. And each challenge, if you're going to go down to the individual level, can be very different than the next one. There's a lot of people that have feelings and opinions about all of these issues and how they should be resolved. So we are anticipating that it isn't going to be easy, but we do. We believe that we've pretty much put together a broad spectrum type approach to this that we can collaboratively come together and address everything. We have a lot of working groups, and funding is always going to be a challenge. It's going to be hard to get the amount of funding that's going to be required to do some of these things. We are talking about making some infrastructure type investments. Getting teams to collaboratively work together is going to be a challenge. There's going to be quite a few issues that we're going to have to address, but we're prepared to do that. We're not coming in expecting that everything is just going to fall into place, which is why we designed the program to be iterative so that we can adapt as the environment changes and make sure that we're ready to address whatever comes next. John?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the sustainability is important. These types of changes, like when we're talking about supportive housing, this is a two-year pilot project. Some of these changes will take 3 to 5 years longer, really for substantive change to be seen. So we have to show in that two-year period that we are making progress, that plans are in place. We've heard from businesses and residents that they want a vision. For some businesses, they're looking at potentially extending their leases. They want to know what the plan is for the city. So we're looking at that. A big part of that is relationship building with the senior levels of government, either for funding this pilot beyond the 2 years or addressing the needs and gaps related to the three crises. And we've had a lot of success. I mean, an initial piece of success was human waste is an issue in our city. Businesses and residents raise it on a pretty well daily basis. It's an issue in all municipalities. But we worked with BC Housing. We now have a sanitation trailer, which offers toilets, sinks, and showers. It operates 24/7. It has attendant services, and BC Housing is covering the full cost of that. So that's been a plus, and we're starting to see some of the positive impacts with regards to a reduced amount of human waste and fewer complaints. And, we're looking at the inhalation component. So some things we can move forward within the two-year period, and some are going to take longer, but we have to show the community what that plan is and what that vision and how it will impact them. And I think, we are getting buy-in as we're sharing that vision, and also recognizing that it's iterative. Like we said, this is a pilot, and we're not going to wait until the end of the 2 years to make changes. If we see something's not working or something needs to change, we'll do that right away.
Great. And you both touched on it a little bit, but I want to ask what your hopes are for the future of this project and program.
I'll talk it from a social planning perspective. Our social planning section is really about trying to assist vulnerable populations, give them a voice, address their needs. There are too many people right now who are unhoused, who are living with mental health and substance use issues. So my hope is that we do provide those facilities, services, and supports so they can become either sheltered or housed, stabilize their lives, connect to services, and over a period of time, have the ability to be part of a community. And that's so important, that whole belonging, connecting. I've always heard that one of the for someone who's unhoused is that feeling of feeling invisible, sitting on a sidewalk and people just walking by and not noticing them. I want to see these individuals feel part of a community, feel connected to a community, feel valued, and have the ability to make a contribution. And I also realize, being a social planner, because I'm going through two temporary use permits related to shelter proposals, is that the community better understands these issues, recognizes just how even childhood trauma can impact a person for the rest of their lives. And through providing supports and services, that change can happen. So that is my hope.
And ideally, that when we design this model, the effects of this model also impact in a positive way the whole community, the businesses and the residents, such that some of the concerns that they express now or some of the issues that they have now, that they're not as prevalent or maybe don't even exist, but also to a point that this whole model could maybe be expanded and taken to other communities throughout the province or other communities that are dealing with this. We are taking a look at this and making sure that what we do is transferable. We're being evaluated by Douglas College, and Douglas College is, that's one of the things they're going to be looking at, is how transferable are the solutions that we have to make sure that they aren't short-lived and limited. They can be used in other communities that have the same concerns.
You've mentioned the evaluation and the fact that the project is iterative. What are the next steps from here?
We've just recently launched, so it did take some time with regards to retaining new staff, onboarding those staff, and working with faith-based nonprofits and provincial teams and developing those relations. So the idea now is that we're out in the community, we're making those connections. The policy and advocacy team will be doing a lot of advocacy around those needs and gaps. And the operations support team will be working with businesses and residents to deal with some of the externalities. Trying to get information out, trying to be as accessible as possible, but really importantly, try to build those relationships. We are a smaller municipality compared to some municipalities, so we're really dependent on relationship building and recognizing that these are senior government responsibilities. We are trying to shift some of the costs from the city, which is bearing those right now, to the senior levels of government. And like I said, we've had some success, so we're going to continue moving forward in that regard.
Yeah, it's much like John said earlier. We spoke how complex this project was, how many moving parts there were. It has been a challenge to get them all up and running at full speed right at the same time, right at the beginning of the project. But I think we're there now. I think we've got most of the moving parts moving, if you will, and it's time to start to actually make a real impact on the community. We recognize there's two components to this. There's a short-term and a long-term component that I think John's alluded to before, and we have the short-term results just starting to grind out or just starting to operate. And what we need to do now is start to take information from that group. And like John said, it's time to really start a real push on that advocacy to the senior level of levels of government, so that the resources that the people out in the field and on the ground have are available to them to have a meaningful impact.
Great. Thanks to both of you. Is there anything else that you think the audience should know about the project?
I think I'll turn it over to Rhea with regards to, if she's there, from more information. She's a communications. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess if anyone's interested, they can go to the webpage. So it's newwestcity.ca/crisis, I believe, /response/project. I can also supply you with the link after the interview. And we also have information that is starting to go out on our social media channels. So we don't have a separate channel per se, but if you're following any of the New Westminster accounts, so Instagram, Facebook, and X, formerly Twitter, we do post some information there as well. We just recently did a Did You Know campaign, which actually points to the point in time homelessness count that John has referred to. So if anyone's interested in looking at those stats, they can find them there.
Great. Thanks a lot to all three of you.
No, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jesse.
Appreciate it.
Thanks to John, Brad, and Rhea for that interview. Find out more about that project, and we'll keep following it. This is Zucchini Castle, Energy Slime. By Energy Slime, sorry.
there.
The city has to make it look like they care about our park since they're taking it away from us.
You just heard from Beth, one of the founding members of the Friends of South Memorial Park Community Group. They're petitioning for the City of Vancouver and the Committee for the FIFA World Cup 2026 to find an alternative to South Memorial Park, which is currently slated to be closed for 18 to 24 months starting in January 2025, in order to prepare the field as a practice pitch for the FIFA World Cup. This planned closure will make the park, as well as its various amenities, completely inaccessible to the surrounding public. Recently, CJSF was able to take a trip down to the park and speak with and hear the concerns of the community group, including the city's current plan to remove 15 trees from the park, seven of which the city has claimed to be dead. However, according to an independent arborist hired by Friends of South Memorial Park, this may not be the case.
One parks board member actually said he came down here and he said, so they've told us they're cutting 15 trees and they've told us seven of them are dead or eight of them are dead. That number seems to change because some trees come back to life, I guess. So we don't know which trees they're going to kill. So that means they're cutting seven or eight healthy trees. So some of these trees actually are 100 years old here. And an arborist has told us that he called them specimens. He said that they're very special, some of these trees. So they've said, this guy said he came down and he looked around and said he did not see any dead trees. And did we know which trees were the dead trees that were coming down? And my response was, there are no dead trees. And to that, we've had no response because that means they're taking down 15 healthy trees for a short-term event.
This statement came from Cindy, another member of the community group and a longtime resident of the surrounding neighborhood against the city and FIFA's current plans for South Memorial Park.
Okay, my connection goes back to when I was little and my grandparents lived in this area. This is where they immigrated to in around 1950. And we would come on Sunday and we'd have dinner and we'd come to this park. And when I was 15, we moved to this neighborhood and I've been living here for 40 years. And this is my park. So, yeah, I go for my walks through here and I meet people. I know people at the pollinator garden. And it's the prettiest part of this part of town, hands down. It's the place to go when you need to just sit on a bench in the sunshine and look at some trees.
Another issue that was brought up had to do with a lack of any sort of communication or statement from the city or FIFA regarding the replacement for the current washrooms at South Memorial Park.
And so I've asked actually repeatedly now. So are we getting porta potties? We have baseball teams, we have lacrosse, we have soccer tournaments that happen. So where are these people going to go to the washroom? Because that will be blocked off. And so they've not answered us on that. There's not a lot of, from what it seems like to me, is there's been a lot of planning to make this great for FIFA. And no planning whatsoever for this community. None. Not even the thought of toilets for the people who will use this park for the 2 years that this is closed.
Afterwards, Beth and Cindy spoke on the response they've gotten from the City of Vancouver as well as the FIFA Vancouver Committee.
So we're out of our park for basically 2 years for like a four-week practice field for elite athletes.
That's basically been the response. We had another response saying, oh, we are concerned about what's happening. They've shown, you judge people by their actions, not by their words, right? They have shown absolutely no care or consideration for the people of this community. None whatsoever. They have updated some of their answers on the FIFA 26 training facility page, but those answers have been in response to our questions.
Since speaking with Beth and Cindy, CJSF has put out a request for further information regarding the park's closure to the designated media contact for the FIFA World Cup 2026 in Vancouver. Unfortunately, we have received no further response, but if you want to learn more about the training sites and the various questions that have been answered, you can go to vancouverfwc26.ca/training-sites. That's vancouverfwc26.ca/training-sites. On this page, you can see certain questions that have been answered regarding the removal of certain trees, as well as the general accessibility of the park from January 2025 to fall 2026, and a short statement regarding the community impacts, which reads, "Public access will be limited during the construction and operational phases from January 2025 to fall 2026. The FIFA World Cup 26 Vancouver host committee recognizes the importance of Memorial South Park to the surrounding communities and the regular visitors who enjoy these sites. To minimize impact on local sports, educational, and community groups, work is underway to seek appropriate locations and alternatives to suit the needs of those impacted. This includes relocating lost field booking times at replacement facilities and ensuring alternate locations are within the same geographical area where possible. As a result of the work done to prepare for host training sessions, these sites will be upgraded to grass sports fields with lights, drainage irrigation systems, and utilities, which will enhance the park's long-term usability. Additionally, when Memorial Park is reopened to the public, it will benefit from a resurfaced track." Once again, this is a statement from the Vancouver FIFA World Cup 2026 committee regarding the community impacts of the Memorial South Park closure. While the park's planned closure in January 2025 and the community impacts are yet to be seen, Friends of South Memorial Park plan to keep rallying against the current decisions made by the city and the Vancouver FIFA 2026 committee, as well as the current planned removal of 15 trees within the park. Once again, this has been Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. And this piece would not be possible without the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. This piece can also be found on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Danny for that piece. Thanks for listening to the show today. Democracy Now! Is up next, and I will talk to you next Thursday.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.